And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. You know, there's a lot going on that this show talks about that other shows sometimes do and sometimes don't, and what we try to do here is we try not to set up labels. So tonight's going to be a conversation, again, about consciousness. It's going to involve the physics, and it's also going to involve one of the most controversial political issues of our time. Oh my God, I said that word again. Politics. I can hear them. Click, 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 click. Actually, it doesn't happen that way this time. You just kind of press your thumb against your screen and weird things pop up and you hit an icon and we go dark. Anyway, my guest this morning is going to talk about the side of consciousness that we've been kind of trying to lay some groundwork for, because politically we have some enormous issues to solve in this country vis-a-vis the DEA and drugs and most particularly marijuana. Tonight, one of the candidates, Bernie Sanders, at the town hall between him and Hillary in Las Vegas, made some very firm and rather interesting pronouncements on the issues. So we'll get to those after I introduce my guest of this morning, who is Chris Conrad, an internationally respected expert on industrial hemp, marijuana cultivation, processing, religious, personal, and medical use, and a court-qualified expert witness who has testified now more than 320 times in state, military, and federal U.S. courts over marijuana laws and legislation and legal issues. Conrad legally grew and processed marijuana in Europe in the 1990s, and curated the Hash Marijuana Hemp Museum in Amsterdam. Oh, Robin and I were in Amsterdam. I guess we're going to have to ask him where it is. And the Oaksterdam Cannabis Museum in Oakland, which I guess is Oakland, California. I used to live right next to Oakland over in Berkeley. His newest book is The Newbie's Guide to Cannabis and the Industry with Jeremy Daw. Conrad is also the author of Hemp, Lifeline to the Future, and Shattered Lives, Portraits from America's Drug War, with his wife, Mickey Norris. His groundbreaking 1997 book, Hemp for Health, was among the first to promote CBD and has been translated now into six languages, including Cannabis para la Salud. His research monograph, Cannabis Yields and Dosage, uses federal medical marijuana and cultivation research to explain principles of producing and consuming medical marijuana, as well as covering the legal issues. Chris, good morning and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on tonight, Richard.
It's really great having you. Now, just lean into that mic a little. We went over some issues before, and apparently your computer, like mine, is hacked so that we can't use the line-in mic. We got to use the inside mic unless you buy an extra set of equipment, and of course there was no time for that. So let me see. Let me ask you the big picture question. Given this society, and I'm only going to talk now about the United States, given our, from the 1930s through the 50s through now, our society and our extraordinary dependence, kind of just to get through the day, on drugs, starting with alcohol and moving into, you know, analgesics and other, you know, barbiturates and painkillers and things now like OxyContin and all that. How come we still live in a society where people taking a toke can basically spend the rest of their lives in prison? Isn't this kind of anomalous in itself?
Well, it's also by design, I would have to say. It was roughly 100 years ago that California passed its first anti-marijuana laws, but actually it was the pharmaceutical industries that first came up with the idea of banning it. At the turn of the 19th into the 20th centuries. And essentially that there was a reason why they wanted to take over the medical industry at that point. And that was to take control of what we would be able to use as medicine. And they've done a pretty good job of it since then.
Why don't we go back and kind of look at that history? Because I think people are very confused as to what's going on now in the country in terms of legalization, medical versus recreation versus federal versus state. Why don't we start at the very beginning and talk about how hemp, the hemp industry, which basically I believe, now correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the Declaration and the Constitution written on hemp paper?
Well, they were drafted on hemp paper. But they were then transcribed onto parchment, which is an animal product.
Okay.
So the copies that people see are actually on parchment, but the all the earlier drafts were on hemp paper. Because basically, hemp was the number one source of paper in the world. In fact, the first paper invented was using hemp, and China and the Romans did it right about the same time, around the first century. And so that this connection to human civilization is very well pronounced. In fact, that I think there's a reason why the word culture and agriculture have a common root. Mm-hmm. And that's because when people began growing crops, and hemp was the first crop that we know they were growing, that's what led to people settling down and being able to build the great cities. Prior to that, it was more of a nomadic lifestyle.
Now, wait. You just said something really interesting. You said we know that hemp was the first crop grown. Are we going back to Sumer and the Indus Valley or the Mayans? Are we looking at ancient civilizations and we have records now, documentation, the seeds, you know, DNA, whatever, that the first cultivated crops were hemp?
Well, what we know is that before the age of fire came along, people were using hemp fiber to reinforce bricks. And that's from two places, China and actually Turkey, I guess, modern-day Turkey.
Kind of like an organic rebar.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, clay holds itself together okay, but the cannabis fiber really strengthens it. And what's so amazing about this, Richard, is that right now the use of hemp for housing material has been seen as one of the massive breakthroughs of the 21st century, because it is so insulative and beneficial in terms of absorbing shocks. It's noise insulative. It's pest resistant. It's fire resistant. It's earthquake resistant. This is something that just in the past 20 years, we've rediscovered again what the Romans knew, which is that if you use hemp fiber and you mineralize it, that you have a building material that is lighter and far superior to concrete.
Okay. So for people who haven't followed this history, including me, take us back to when hemp really was used in all kinds of products that, quote, consumers, you know, a modern invention of a term that really means the people who basically need to use stuff to live, worked with all the way up through the early United States, because I don't think people appreciate how widespread hemp, that the plant, was in culture and technology and in everyday use, which is what makes its current situation so, again, anomalous.
Yeah, it's pretty potent stuff. The Herodotus, the Greek historian, wrote about I'm talking ancient Greece, 450 BC roughly. He wrote about the Thracians and the Scythians as being two groups that that spread hemp around Europe, and they said the quality was as good as the finest linen. But they noted that both of these groups had a purification ritual in which they would build a hut. And when the elder or the chief died, they would build a fire in the hut, throw cannabis on it, and then go in and stay in the smoke. And then they said they would emerge howling with laughter. And this was one of the traditions. Meanwhile, in the Bible, we've actually got reference to cannabis as an anointing oil that the priests use. In addition to all the general things it says about plants being created by God and given to people and so forth, the Zoroaster actually described riding on a cloud of hash up to past the gods that were manifest, and he found that there was the only one God and everything else was a manifestation. So the first written record of a monotheistic church actually was based on cannabis use, but it was primarily this use as rope and fiber. It was the word canvas actually derives from the word cannabis, and that's because it was the primary fiber that the Romans used because it was so durable. And then they discovered that it was the only fiber that could stand up to the salt water from the ocean.
Oh,
and so the great sailing ships of the
oh my God, like the Clippers, like the Flying Cloud, you know, all those incredible, like the Cutty Sark, you know, brigantine, all those sails, you're saying, were made of hemp.
Right, because hemp has some silicone in the fiber that resists salt water.
Ah, okay.
And so they used it in the caulking, they used it in the sails, they used it in the ropes and the rigging, and also, of course, the captain's log would be written on hemp paper, the sailors' clothing were made out of old hemp, and they carried actually a barrel of hemp seed with them so that if they ever got shipwrecked, they would be able to grow the next season, after they grew the hemp, they could repair the ship and go on their way again.
That's stunning. That's remarkable. Which means also if you had a shipwreck and the captain's log went down with the ship, if it's on hemp paper, the seawater wouldn't attack it the way it would linen and other organic fibers, and you find the log someday maybe.
Right, yeah, so it's not as...
I wonder if that was deliberate or it was just a kind of a byproduct of use. In other words, hemp really was an industry, a major industry. Can you quantify the hemp industry at, let's say, the turn of the century in the United States compared to other industries that were fledgling at that time, like oil, like, communications, train, transportation, rail, that kind of thing?
Basically, you to really know it, you would have to go back a few hundred years. During the Napoleonic era, Roman times, through the Napoleonic era, the American Revolution. That was the era when hemp was really almost the primary industry of the world. And the shipping and all that. Obviously, those were industries, but they were all tied into hemp, of course. And most of the productivity was connected into hemp products. The windmills, for example, that ground up the food, they got their energy from the sails that were usually made out of hemp and turning the windmills and so forth. So it was really the dominant industry. But then cottaging got invented, that's when things turned around for hemp. And so at the end of the 18th century to the end of the 19th century, we saw a big decline in hemp production. So when the time period when you're talking about, hemp was actually a fairly small industry. And that's how they managed to ban it, because it was at the low point of throughout all human history, it was at the lowest point of use was at the beginning of the 20th century.
So that was coincidental, or was it because there were other technologies and inventions and processes that proved to be better than hemp?
Well, a kind of a combination. The first thing that came along was the cotton gin, because that made cotton a competitive fiber, not as strong as hemp, not as good a quality, but cheaper to produce. And so the other thing that came up with that was slavery. Slavery increased by a factor of four times as many slaves in the United States from the invention of the cotton gin to the Civil War. And so it changed to where people had more access to less expensive cotton textiles. And so then hemp was primarily then relegated. The other thing that happened not too long afterwards is we have the steam engine. We have the steam ships coming along, replacing the sailing ships that had been used for so long. Hemp was being used in the covered wagons and stuff going across the country and things like that. But essentially, America had turned away from wind power to fossil fuels at that point. And the DuPont company was majorly involved in this big transition was going on. The other big thing that came along was trees being made into paper instead of hemp. Once that happened, it led the Department of Agriculture to write a series of documents saying that we were going to destroy our family farms and destroy our forests if we didn't change that back to growing hemp for our paper.
In terms of renewables, it takes, 20, 30 years to grow a tree you cut down, make into a table? It takes how many months to grow a big, hemp, a fibrous plant, marijuana, et cetera? The recycling rate is so much faster. Again, I'm looking for what factor entered in that created this stunning dichotomy to where now an industry that was the backbone of the country, we're basically discussing politically, is it possible we can use this to save some kids who respond to nothing else? I mean, it just seems to me that we've taken this incredible political transition light years beyond where it would have naturally gone, and I'm looking for those unknown factors, and you're saying that it's basically the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical industry.
But that means, hang on.
Petrochemical industry.
Sorry to interrupt, but that means that at some point hemp had to go from a fiber, a paper, a cloth, a utilitarian, material into the what was in the plant if you smoked it, or certain parts of the plant if you smoked it. When did that? When was that? That had to be with humanity, you know, for thousands of years. When did it become suddenly evil?
Well, again, we go to Napoleon time for part of that, because this is when the Turkish, the Ottoman Empire was great, and they were very much in the hash.
The Ottoman Empire.
The French and the Ottoman Turks did a lot of back and forth. But it was really the British in India that made this discovery that cannabis was an important medicine. And so at the 19th century, it became used in more and more different medicines, more than 100 different medicines. Scientific studies were done all over the place. Then this is when the pharmaceutical drug industry started to make its move to single molecule drugs instead of organic
medicines. When was the AMA created?
I'm not really sure. I don't really know when the AMA was created. Sorry.
Was it the 1920s? See, I should probably ask our producer. Uh-huh. And an answer will appear magically in the digital age. So we'll put that out in the ether. When did the AMA, you know, when was it formed? Because it seems to me we might compare the rise of organized medicine and pharmaceutical industries attached to doctors with the decrease in natural, you know, healing modalities going all the way back to Aboriginal peoples. Again, I don't know whether people really realize, but in terms of a society, in terms of a culture, and we're kind of moving away from this now, but up until relatively recently, we were one of the most anal retentive cultures in the history of humankind when it comes to mind-altering plants and the pharmacopoeia that's in nature. And again, how did we get into this untenable position?
Well, it seems like the nexus really came to this power struggle that part of it culminated in the Marijuana Tax Act, because the American Medical Association was against the Marijuana Tax Act being imposed, because they said that there was medical value to the plant that had not been discovered, and it was already known to have some value, but they said this potential had not really been investigated enough to ban it.
Okay, hang on.
But it was a pharmaceutical company that was determined to assert this single molecule medical system onto the AMA, and they kind of won that battle around this time, and then the AMA succumbed and they became allies.
Okay, the AMA was formed, according to M's research, in 1847, American Medical Association. So that's well before, like a century before what I'm looking at in terms of the intense politicalization and criminalization of a natural healing plant that's been part of humanity for millennia. Again, that takes a lot of political know-how to make that inversion happen. That's what I want to focus in on. How did we get where we are tonight in terms of the politics?
And so, as I said, so the pharmaceutical companies, the AMA came from the period of herbalism and homeopathy and so forth. And then it made it at the beginning of the 20th century, that's when the pharmaceutical industry decided to impose its will upon it. And so they were eliminating different kind of other medicines like opium and things like that, the natural form of these things. And getting it into, like, instead of coca, it would be cocaine, you know, the single molecules. And so basically my understanding is that this thing with the Marijuana Tax Act was partially a culmination about that, but it was also this whole racist, system of, Jim Crow that came to play at the same time. And at the same time, we had the fact that alcohol prohibition had ended. There was a whole federal agency looking for a job to do to enforce something. And then enter into that the fact that this new machine was invented to process hemp and make it more affordable than cotton and timber for paper and so forth. These all happened at the same point in the 1920s. Actually, that's when they also distilled THC out of the marijuana plant. The 1920s was this period where a huge potential for advanced step forward on cannabis came into play. But instead of that, we got the Marijuana Tax Act pushed down our throat through Congress.
That's the fulcrum I want to focus on, because that's where history went wonkers. up until that point, there was an ample amount of evidence, you know, please disagree if you need to, that marijuana, that hemp, that the medicinals derived from these plants actually positively affected human health in very, very striking ways. How did politically the AMA, or actually the pharmaceutical company working through the AMA, get doctors to turn their backs on all this empirical evidence and basically go with patent medicines in a bottle?
Well, the AMA was against the Marijuana Tax Act, but once it got passed, Harry Anslinger, who is famous for writing the script for the movie Reefer Madness, although he wrote it as a magazine article, not the movie script itself, but right. the story was based on, he made that up. He had sent federal police to go after doctors. Like, there was a group of doctors in New York who were hired by the mayor, LaGuardia, to do a review of all the negative things that were being said about marijuana. And they found out not only that they were not true, but they strongly came out that the consequences of banning the cannabis were much more horrendous. Among the other things, they pointed out that people were drinking more alcohol in New York after marijuana got banned. And so Anslinger had his agency go after all these doctors and Anslinger
was
DuPont's son-in-law.
Okay.
Oh, excuse me, not DuPont. Mellon's son-in-law. Mellon was the banker for the DuPonts, and he was the head of the Treasury earlier on, and so his influence was still strong. Anslinger's actual job was he was in charge of enforcement of alcohol prohibition.
Okay.
And then after that, he needed a new job.
Okay. So all of these factors then led us to where we are tonight. Now, you said in a conversation you and I had earlier this evening that you're kind of struck by what's going on now, that you can't believe what's happening. What did you mean by that?
Well, the turnaround on this issue has been, like I said, there's been this 100 years, but we've gone through at least two other big waves. We had Nixon do his drug war, then we had Reagan's drug war, and actually you'd even say that Clinton launched a major drug war that goes on to this day. But the public opinion has turned around so much on this issue that we are right now at a point, Richard, where we might be able to see marijuana legalized all the way from Mexico to, if we pass this bill in California next year, California, Oregon, and Washington are already legal. Canada, the new governor up there says they're going to legalize marijuana, and Alaska's legal. So it will be legal marijuana all the way from Alaska down to Guatemala.
Okay. How many states currently have legalized medical marijuana?
It kind of depends because, you know, there's this stuff that CBD – which you mentioned during my introduction, which doesn't have the psychoactive effect. So when people say medical marijuana, are you talking about only the THC varieties that have a psychoactive effect, or are we talking about these non-psychoactive effects?
I'm including both.
Okay, so there's something around 30 different states that have something, and more than in the high 20s, they have THC, and then there's a half a dozen or so that have CBD only.
In terms,
even
of,
though it's not as effective because it's not psychotropic, as I mentioned, some states have put that limit on its use.
Okay. Now, I mean, in other words, the states have basically taken the medical control from the doctors and prescribed that this is useful and this is not useful, and that's a bizarre situation. I mean, is that going to change?
Well, the weirdest thing is the federal government holds a patent on medical use of marijuana.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. And they also have a federal program for medical marijuana called the Investigational New Drug Program, and they deliver it free to patients. They've been doing it since 1976, and they say it's not medicine at the same time that they're doing it.
Isn't that – well, it's federal policy. What can I say? Okay, so about 30 states – in one form or another, are on board with medical marijuana under various prescriptions or restrictions. How many states do we now have that have authorized recreational use?
We have four, plus Washington, D.C.
Okay. So there,
which is interesting, too, because that's a federal territory.
Yes, of course. Overseen by Congress.
Exactly. And so this dichotomy that you're talking about, it's very profound. It's ongoing.
Well, as we move through this process, obviously you're anticipating now, as per our conversation a few hours ago, that more states are going to authorize medical marijuana. that more states are going to reexamine their current medical marijuana laws so that it's not restricted just to one component. Because in the naturalistic, herbalist medical realm, it's the synergy of different molecules and different compounds that make things work. And when you try to isolate back to the pharmacopoeia of, you know, single molecules and then patent and sell that, you lose that synergy between all the other elements that the plant, you know, evolved with, you know, lives with, and is part of how it works medicinally.
Yeah, that's a great observation. And right now, one of the things I'm writing about in my new book, The Newbie's Guide to Cannabis and the Industry, and Jerry McDaw actually wrote more of this section, is that people are discovering that it's not just the THC and CBD and so-called cannabinoids in the plant, but these other compounds called terpenes that also have a big effect on it. Like, for example, some people, when they smoke marijuana, that makes them tired. But if they smoke a different strain, it might make them feel energetic. And we now don't think that's the THC or the CBD. We think that's the limonene, for example, as one of the terpenes that could give that effect. So, you know, it's, as you said, not only is it the interaction of the specific medicinal compounds, but even these other compounds, which are not traditionally seen as being medicinal, seem to affect the experience and the medical benefit.
So are we really, in terms of the whole marijuana controversy, legal, medical, are we looking at a potential revolution in medicine to where the holistic approach is, as marijuana takes more and more political high ground and ultimately wins, and I think I see the trend curve just about the way you do, is that going to impact on the pharmaceutical industry where people, real doctors, are going to say, well, wait a minute, if this works on all these various problems up to and including cancer, then how does it work? And if they figure out how, we're back to holistic combinations of elements and compounds as opposed to single molecule miracle drugs?
Well, that's a really good question. And one thing I've definitely noticed, Richard, doing I've spoken at scientific conferences and policy conferences around the world. And one of the things that was most amazing for me was when I went to Uruguay, where the government has decided to legalize marijuana.
That's in the last year or so, isn't it?
Yeah, that was 2014 that they did that.
Okay.
And then I don't know how the sales are going. From what I understand, they still don't really have a very good supply chain built up. But nonetheless, we went to this medical conference, and one of the things that we heard there was these doctors saying that they have a very high use of certain kinds of medications for stress and stuff like that. I'm all of a sudden spacing out of the words for it, but Valium, there you go. They're one of the highest uses of Valium in the world. And when they heard how cannabis affects people, they said, so this gives us a way of getting away from the pharmaceutical drug companies and giving our people something they can actually grow for themselves and reducing all the side effects that are associated with Valium. We have to get onto this right away. We shouldn't even waste any time doing more research. We should start just making it available to people and then measuring what their responses are. And I was thinking, you would never hear that in the United States. A government official saying, we could take this away from the pharmaceutical drug companies and do our own research.
Amazing. Another reason to build a wall to the south. Okay. You're on the other side of midnight, everybody. My guest this morning is Chris Conrad. We're discussing the M word. No, producer, please sit down. The M word, marijuana, and the red, white, and blue. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
White the purity of love, like a bride and a groom. We'll always stand united. We will not be divided. There's too much to lose. Blue are the waters surrounding the brave patriots. From sea to shining sea. Red, the blood of innocence, volunteer.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. You're not going to believe it, but it's 55 degrees outside our studio tonight in the Land of Enchantment. You heard me give numbers 17, 19.5, in the 20s. It's summer. It's summer. For everyone who thinks global warming is not real, come to the land of enchantment tonight. Okay. Let me return back to a couple of issues. You know, hemp used to be really, really, really essential to our society. Because of technological changes, it became less, you know, important. There were then some breakthroughs where medical uses were looked at. Doctors got excited. And then somebody slammed down the wall. And now, almost 100 years later, we're seeing, you know, a light on the eastern horizon. We're seeing it, you know, in various states. We're seeing it from Washington. We're seeing it at the level of you know, doctors and researchers and medical people. We're seeing all kinds of touted, you know, potential breakthroughs. We're seeing, you know, hour-long documentaries on CNN, which really, I think, Chris, politically turned the tide in the last couple, 3 years. Because when Sanjay Gupta basically went on television and said, "I was wrong," a huge wave of change began to roll across the country, right?
I couldn't agree with you more. There were really two critical things that happened. One was the discovery of the endocannabinoid system in the human body. It's kind of like discovering that we had a nervous system or a gastrointestinal system, a whole new body system that was discovered.
And
that
wait. Don't pass that up. Who did that and when?
Well, actually, it was discovered by the Israeli doctor, Rafael Nachulam, who is also credited with defining THC, the molecule.
Okay.
Even though I would give somebody else, or Roger Adams, the person I would credit with the discovery of THC. But so that really changed the whole medical understanding, and they discovered we have at least a two-part endocannabinoid system, which reacts with the different parts of the plant. And so that's how they discovered that the way it works on these spastic disorders. And that's what really got Dr. Gupta to switch his position when he saw the way that it helped children with seizures.
Mm. Dramatic. I mean, television exists for the picture. You know, we're doing kind of radio with pictures. By the way, we have some pictures from you up there on the site tonight, so we want to get to those at the appropriate time. But when Sanjay Gupta showed that little girl having, like, what, 100 seizures a day, and now she has none, and she's normal, and she's happy, and she's laughing, I mean, that visual image of cannabis helps, I think, was the single biggest political advancement in the last 10 years.
I tend to agree with you, and particularly as you mentioned, the fact that he said, "I was wrong."
Yes.
He gave people a way of changing their mind.
Yep.
And the other thing that was very strange is that happened like within 2 months, I think, the Cole memo was handed down, which where the federal government said they would stop harassing states that have a robustly enforced and tightly regulated system of marijuana control. I've often wondered if there's a relationship between those two events.
And hang on. I think I may have new news for you. Who was President Barack Obama's first choice to be Surgeon General of the United States?
Well, could the initials be SG by any chance?
You got it.
So Sanjay Gupta himself was considered for that position.
Yep. And he very publicly turned it down. He said he wanted to stay in a public educational role of television, which I thought was a good choice because he's much more effective. And then when he went through his conversion, and then they went with what? The second doc, Weed 2. It's like you could see there was a political plan in place to increase the state's experimentation to demonstrate that the reefer madness is mad, and to move us to the next level. And again, you and I talked this afternoon about the rate at which it's happening. To me, I'm not that surprised because as part of our arsenal to kind of approach this analysis, we have this model of the torsion field physics, which not only changes physical things, but also affects consciousness. And to me, the timing of the legalization experimentation now and the peak of the physics coming between 2016 and 2017 seems almost to be time to create a political wave where this set of issues no longer confronts us and we can ask the real question, which is, what can marijuana do to improve the quality of life of every person in this country, starting just in this country?
I love your analysis. I think the timing that you're describing is really absolutely right on point with it. There's going to be probably at least 4 to 6 states that have legalization initiatives on the ballot this year.
Do we have their names?
I don't really remember them all. If you go to mpp.org, mpp.org, that you'll be able to look them up. They do the tracking. But I know that Nevada is one of them that they consider to be likely, and I believe Maine. The problem we have here, Richard, is that only a certain number of states actually have the ability of the voters to make policy. And so that kind of restricts how many there are.
You mean in terms of initiatives and referenda?
You're correct. Exactly.
And, well, California is a huge one. I remember actually trying to get signups, you know, out in malls and parking lots and post office parking lots and all that to get signups for Reagan to convince him to basically initiate the space station. So I'm kind of familiar with the grassroots efforts of getting initiatives on the ballot in California. Talk a bit about the Adult Use of Marijuana Act, which I take it is the ballot initiative in California to move from where California is currently to what? Total recreational and medical use?
Yeah, you could look at it that way. It's actually it's an interesting law. I'm quite impressed with it. The Adult Use of Marijuana Act, some people call it the Sean Parker Initiative because he was the major funder behind it. But essentially what they did, the authors of it, was to look at a whole series of different things. They looked at what's happened in Colorado, what happened in Washington State, what happened in Ohio when they tried to legalize it, the only state that so far has voted to not do it in this recent wave of votes.
Do you want to kind of describe why? Because Ohio looks contradictory, but in fact, I don't think it is.
No, not at all, because what happened in Ohio was a financial oligarchy, basically, of 10 groups putting in money to buy the rights to have marijuana.
Yeah, the 1%, the 10th of 1%, whatever. Anyway, they wanted to basically tie up and monopolize the whole cannabis industry so you could only buy it under this law from them.
Uh-huh. But however, conversely, I actually thought it was not so bad because it would allow people to grow their own and to give it away to each other. Yeah. And personally, that's my favorite way for marijuana to be is transferred around, is for people to grow it and share it with their friends.
Right. But ultimately, the industry came out against the law and it was defeated because people basically said, no, we don't want to be, you know, bound to 10 suppliers.
Yeah, exactly. And so the California one actually has a lot of support for the try to bring the existing industry above board. It favors you have to be a California resident to get a license to sell it. You would have to if you already have a license under the current medical marijuana system, you would be favored for getting into the system. Prior arrests won't be counted against people. Putting special emphasis on what they call micro size and small size businesses to encourage people to get on a small level. And they're holding out large businesses for 5 years. The other thing they do is they forbid undercutting prices. I don't know if you may be able to, there might be a better way of saying that, but where they can come in, a big company comes in, they can't sell things at a loss to undercut the competition and drive them out of business and then raise prices.
In other words, drive the mom-and-pop stores out of business.
Right, yeah. The idea is to protect what we've got as much as we can right now, which is really not that easy, to tell you the truth, Richard, because people have been in this gray market for ever since Proposition 215 and Senate Bill 420 here in California.
And what year was those?
I think it might be good to just to sum up, though, what the initiative does, though, is it legalizes adults over the age of 21 to have 1 ounce of marijuana, 8 grams of concentrate, some amount of edibles, which is going to be, you know, comparable to that, and to grow 6 plants in an enclosed space anywhere in the state. So right now, where medical marijuana is banned in different parts of the states for home grows, this would make it so that any adult can grow at a per parcel basis.
And this will be on the ballot this coming November in 2016 as part of the general election, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And what are the poll numbers looking like right now?
Around 55%.
55 positive?
That's right.
So it's 5% more than needed to pass.
Right. But actually, when it comes to elections, that's not considered a very safe margin.
Oh, no, not at all.
10%.
So who's doing the campaign in favor of this?
Well, the group is it's called Let's Get It Right, and they're actually they have quite a good name there for their website. Although I don't know if I
was going to say if they had any prominent Republicans, that'd be cool.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, they I think they're going to have them because you know Dana Rohrabacher, the Orange County Republican.
Really,
he's the one who introduced the federal hemp bill. He's the one who introduced the in Congress, that is to say. He's right. Also the one who put in banking legislation reform. He's also introduced a bill for states' rights on marijuana regulation and to cut the DEA funding when they went after the hemp fields in Kentucky and to cut it again when they went after the medical marijuana dispensaries here in California.
Good
so he's been very strong on this issue.
Wow. He's also very positive on space. We've had a couple of very interesting conversations. Some of my readers have actually sent him letters to ask him to look into some things at NASA, and he's been very positive.
Oh, well, that's great. Yeah, he's quite a guy and a musician, too, if you ever get a chance to have him play a song for you.
Oh, really? That would be cool.
Yeah.
All right, so what is his relationship to the act? Rohrabacher.
He doesn't really have a relationship because he's federal. He's been doing.
I understand, but I mean, is he on a stump? Is he speaking in favor of it? Is he, you know, because these initiatives obviously have supporters.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things though, Richard, is that people don't really like to say that they don't like to endorse things until they're on the ballot. So I think that we're in a position now where the behind-the-scenes stuff is going on. But we're anticipating a good chance that he's going to endorse it. And then there's Judge Gray, the Libertarian Republican judge from federal judge from Orange County, who's retired now. He's likely to endorse it too. So you're just asking about were we expecting to get some Republican support, and I think we really are.
And does the campaign in favor of it have enough money to do television? Because television is where it's at.
Well, this is where the idea of having a wealthy benefactor is just so great. Sean Parker has apparently committed somewhere for like $5 to $15 million to make this happen.
That's significant. Now, what's his background?
Well, he's from one of the Facebook co-founders.
Okay.
And he formed a company called Napster at one point.
Oh, infamous Napster?
Yeah, the infamous
Napster. He's the Napster guy. Okay, so
right.
he's kind of like the Paul Allen is to SETI. This guy is to marijuana legalization.
Yeah, in a certain way. He was, you know, with the whole Napster thing, a lot of people say, well, what's his motive? And I'm thinking, well, with Napster, you know, he wasn't trying to take over the music industry. He was trying to make music free. And, of course, that hurt a lot of people whose incomes depended upon royalties. So, you know, but
yeah,
I don't think
like the creative people who created, you know. I'm all in favor of free stuff, but when you get to the creative folks, how do you compensate creativity if everything is owned by everybody and nobody owns anything? I mean, that's a really philosophical show that we ought to do some night because, again, the idea of Napster was interesting, but look what it did to the recording industry.
Right, yeah. So, but anyway, I'm just saying that this is how people know of him basically is from that.
Okay.
And so, he, like I said, he made up enough money from Facebook that he decided to put his money where his beliefs are, which is really towards this, harm reduction. And, the impact of doing these changes is really profound though, because as you probably know, Richard, when people get arrested for marijuana, it affects their ability to get a job, their ability to get a loan, their ability to get educational funds, their ability to get housing. And so, you know, this is not something that just benefits businesses. This is something that's going to benefit real people in real time.
Absolutely. Now, obviously you weren't watching, or maybe you were, the Democratic town hall this evening, Hillary and Bernie.
I saw a piece of it, but not the part you wanted to talk about.
Okay, let me talk about what I want to talk about on this, because this is really cool. the two moderators, Chuck Todd and Ballart, got some really great questions. The audience questions were superb, and they were able to do follow-ups, which forced the candidates to be specific. Bernie was asked the question on legalizing marijuana. And I think he's the only presidential candidate. I certainly know he's the only one on the Democratic side. I'm not sure about Trump. I don't think Trump wants to legalize marijuana. I know Christie was adamantly opposed to any further expansion of legalization. And the various other candidates are all falling basically in line against legalization. Bernie Sanders said some very profound things. He talked about the impact on young lives, how you can get a record and completely derail your entire life for doing something that everybody has done, Nobody in this audience has not smoked a toke at some point in their lives. You know, fess up, be honest. So the idea that this affects and shatters, you know, your career, your life, your dreams and everything, Sanders not only appears to get it, but he says he wanted to remove marijuana from the FDA's schedule drugs, because they've got drugs on a kind of a, you know, danger scale, schedule one, schedule two, that kind of thing. Marijuana is now, I believe, a schedule one drug up there with heroin and cocaine and other things. He wants to remove it so that you can do research on it, you can grow it, you're not penalized, it no longer is a felony. It will change society. And there's a presidential candidate in 2016 who is avidly and actively and aggressively running on a let's stop this nonsense of the last 100 years, and he's winning.
It's quite an impressive situation that he's generated there. As you mentioned, with the DEA's drug scheduling, one thing I want to point out there, though, is that actually marijuana is up with opium and coca. It's not like those safe drugs that are in the lower levels like morphine and methamphetamine and cocaine. So just to keep that straight, the pharmaceutical drug versions are one step below the plant versions in the DEA's drug scheduling scheme, which is a little suspicious to me about how it all goes. But what's so profound there, Richard, is that we have been talking about this issue for quite a long time within the cannabis reform movement, because it's clear that that's the way we have to change the federal law, is through the scheduling process. But we've been always talking about rescheduling it to a lower schedule because we didn't think that people were really able to grasp the kind of profound shift that it takes to remove it from the schedule completely. And then along comes Bernie Sanders, and just in a series of about three times during his campaign, by the third time he is talking about removing it from the schedule, something that we were afraid to broach within the movement.
And what's striking about this, Chris, is that this is not an act that requires any legislation. As I understand it, if you go back and actually look at the authorizing legislation, the executive, you know, the president, has broad discretionary powers how the regulations are written. So the FDA has put in, per its authority, these drugs on these schedules to basically be a kind of a, you know, Homeland Security danger, you know, red is danger and green is okay. So one is danger, and I forget what the lowest number is on that schedule. Sanders is proposing, as part of executive orders, simply removing marijuana from that vicious schedule. And if you look at federal penitentiary inhabitants, something like the 200,000 that are in federal prison, there's an awful lot of those that are in federal prison, not local, you know, jails, but federal prison because of marijuana. This would stunningly undercut cartels. It would undercut all kinds of societal ills that we have from simply cramming people into prisons who do not belong in prison. In other words, he's talking about a political revolution, Chris. And this is one of the, you know, Hillary said he's a, you know, Johnny One Note. Well, forget the banks, forget, you know, Wall Street. If he was to do this one thing, it would transform the country in so many ways and would lighten the load on so many people that it would create its own mini revolution at the grassroots level.
I couldn't agree more. This goes back to the Controlled Substance Act passed by Nixon because he didn't like the anti-war protesters, basically, and he knew they smoked marijuana. So he gave the what happened was that when the bill, the Controlled Substances Act, got passed, it put the president in charge of the attorney general, who's in charge of the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA, who's in charge of the schedule. So the head of the DEA or the attorney general or the president can, like, within 5 minutes change all that.
Yep.
And then – in addition to everything you just pointed out there, Richard, you've got the entire hemp industry that's unleashed.
Now, given that hemp proved to not be able to supplant other technologies that came on kind of at the turn of the last century, what new hemp products are now possible if certain restrictions were removed legally that would basically bring it back to the forefront?
Well, the first thing I would say is the housing materials, because you don't need to have very much processing to do that. If you wanted to go to textiles or something like that, you need to have a big amounts of hemp fiber, and it's going to have to be combed and ready to go. We have to have a whole new – restore the infrastructure that's been destroyed. But when it comes to the construction materials, you can actually easily use the hemp to make into hemp wool and felts for that are then used with compressed with resins to make structural support systems. You can make it into a chipboard comparable to everything that wood chipboards are like, except it's lighter weight and has a lot of different insulative advantages. You can make it into grind it up and mix it with lime and calcium, basically, or cement, really, just to make the simplest way of describing. You take the hemp, crush it up, mix it up with cement, and it makes this very lightweight concrete that, again, is more insulative, pest resistant, mildew resistant, et cetera. Huge advantages over it. And you don't need a lot of technology to crunch it up and mix it up with cement. You know what I mean?
And you have that stringy organic rebar in the concrete.
Exactly. And we're back to, this is why our ancestors 10,000 years ago, or 6,000 years ago, depending on when you think the world began. But, but we have 10,000 years of archaeological history showing that people have been using it. And today it seems like one of our best things. It could solve the housing crisis. It could reduce our energy usage.
Hypoallergenic.
You don't need pesticides to keep insects out with this stuff, because the combination of the kind, it basically crystallizes into a fossilized form of the hemp products that are in when you use this hempcrete. And so as it crystallizes, it looks like razor blades as far as insects are concerned. And so they just don't get into it.
Hmm.
It's another interesting thing about it is that the older the material gets, the stronger it gets. It's like fossilization, you know, really, as opposed to most of the time you think your building materials become degraded over time. But in the case of this, it actually can become stronger over a period of time. And so that would be the first place to get in. I think then you've got the possibility of doing the craft industries, meaning for like small paper. The seed oil industry is really big. The one area where Canada has made a huge step forward has been growing hemp, not for fiber, but for the seed, which is then used in either mixed into foods as what they call the whole material is called hemp nuts or hemp kernels. And then there's you can use it for making a milk substitute. They make a substitute for cheese out of it. It's used in breakfast cereals. It's just an amazing plant that's got – we haven't really talked about the nutritional potential of the hemp seed, which is known as the king of seeds in ancient Persia. It was so nutritious.
Hmm. Well, when we come back, I want to talk about your book, Newbie's Guide. Is that the full title, Newbie's Guide to Cannabis?
And the industry,
because the industry is a crucial part. Should we talk about some of these images before we go to break, or are they part of the book?
I don't think that they're
– Let's go to –
There may be one or two of them in the book, but not too many.
Okay, so let's go to othersideofmidnight.com, go to the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, click on that. That takes you to tonight's guest page. Scroll down under Radio with Pictures, and why don't we just, you know, you take us through these images and tell us what's going on.
All right. Well, whoever put this together did a good job of putting in chronological order for us.
Cool.
That upper left-hand corner, that's from 1993.
Image number one.
Yeah, picture number one. And the gentleman on the left there is Ben Dronkers. He is the owner of Sensi Seed Bank, the Hash Marijuana and Hemp Museum, and Hemp Flax Corporation, among other things. And he hired my wife, Mickey, in the middle there, and me on the right to design and curate the Hash Marijuana Hemp Museum. And that was the grand opening after we had designed it. And as you see, we were leaving Holland the next day, and if you see that giant bud that he gave us, there was no way we could finish it that night. So we left with a friend, and when we got back, guess what? They had smoked it up.
Okay. I'm noticing that you're holding the buds and he's holding a glass. What's with that?
Well, he actually didn't smoke bud that much. He liked to smoke hashish mixed in with tobacco.
Interesting.
Okay.
So let's go to number two.
After I had done the museum and come back. Actually, I started my whole process like in 1988. So this is like already 5 years in by the time you get to photo number one. And I have been working with Jack Herer. For people who don't know, Jack Herer is the author of the book The Emperor Wears No Clothes. And I designed and edited that book with him. And so this is a picture when we were working on the California Hemp Initiative together. A version of which is still being circulated to this day. In fact, people will probably see someone out there circulating it.
Like your lapel pin. Can I get one of those? I have a whole bunch of NASA lapel pins. People would freak out if I walked around with a marijuana lapel pin. That would. I have a whole bunch of people. I can hear their heads exploding right now.
Exactly.
Okay.
This is why we're working on one of those campaigns. And then if you go down to the number three, our friend Virginia Reznor and then my wife Mickey in the middle again. This is back in her curly hair era.
Okay.
And me on the right looking at it from this direction, of course. And so this is where we did the human rights and the drug war exhibit for the first time in San Francisco. It was in conjunction with the 50th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. We took a copy of the Declaration of Human Rights and we then took stories and photos of drug war prisoners and match them to show how the United States drug war systematically violates the human rights that are guaranteed, as well as, by the way, we also had the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights included in there as well, showing how many of our fundamental rights are being violated in the name of the drug war. What was really amazing about that one, Richard, is that we had it up, and it was like hundreds of pictures that people walked through, and it said that all these people were in prison. And when people come out the other day, they said, what country is arresting all these Americans and putting them in prison for so long for just marijuana and stuff? So then we had to go back and put American flags all over it so that people knew that we were talking about this was happening in the United States, because the drug war, people don't know that people get multiple life sentences, that we have the death penalty for growing marijuana in this country, that being a girlfriend of somebody who's a drug dealer can put you in prison for 20 years or longer. But when you hear these stories of these people, answering a phone gets people in prison for 5 years or more. Having a gun, which is a Second Amendment right, if you happen to have marijuana at the same time, you could be in prison for 10 years for that. Okay. And, it really opened up a lot of people's eyes to what happened. And it's actually ultimately the United Nations is now reconsidering the drug war. And I think to some extent it was because of our early work in bringing this to their attention.
Fascinating. My guest this morning, Chris Conrad, we're talking about the M word, marijuana, in all of its dimensions. And we're going to define that in the next hour. We're going to talk about his book, his new book. We're going to have your phone calls. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. Back on the other side of midnight on this interesting Friday morning. Let's get back to the pictures and then I want to get to your book. Number four has a guy pointing toward an island.
That's actually the Seattle Hemp Fest. It's the world's biggest protestable, they call it, because it's a festival in support of cannabis and a protest. We have like roughly 150,000 to 200,000 people who come to Seattle the second weekend or third weekend of August every year. And I really recommend people to get there. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience to go there. Or, I mean, I shouldn't say once-in-a-lifetime because it's every year, but I mean, you should do it once in your lifetime is what I meant by that.
So they show up for the salmon run and then they smoke a joint afterwards.
Yeah, right. So it's quite nice, you know, the 1 year before the election, we were like talking about it, and it was very divisive, the question of the legalization, because it was some restrictions to that, which I actually didn't like either. But it was great coming back the next year, and it was legal to have an ounce of marijuana in your pocket and walk around. That was a good feeling.
I'll bet it was. Okay, number five?
This is from my wife and my trip down to Argentina. We actually were invited to, by the government of Uruguay to speak there. And then our friends in Argentina set up events for us across Argentina, speaking events and trainings for doctors and things like that. And we went all the way into Chile. So we spent something like four or six weeks or whatever traveling through there. And it, what's funny about that, Richard, is that my book, Hemp for Health, translated to Cannabis para la Salud, was translated into Spanish. And it turned out to be a really big hit down there, and I didn't even know about it. So when I went down there, all of a sudden I was being treated like a celebrity. And that was, you know, when you're in the cannabis reform movement, you don't get treated like a celebrity very often. So it was a lot of fun.
Okay. Image number six.
And that's the most recent event that we had here. Those last, it was 2010 was in Seattle, and then 2014 was in Argentina. This is in 2015, where my wife, Mickey, and I got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Emerald Cup in Sonoma County, California. And you notice in the picture, that's her behind me as well as in front of me. That's because of the big screen.
It looks
like they're standing in a row, but she got to give her speech first. And so, it was a lot of fun. Again, we don't get treated like rock stars very often, but that day we kind of felt like it.
Well, it must be incredibly gratifying to actually see progress. I mean, so many activists, so many people I've known have worked their entire lives, and it's still like, are we going to make it? Are we going to win? Is it going to shift? It really looks dramatically like, you know, you reach the crest of the mountain and you're going down the other side.
In fact, I don't think our movement knows how to handle it.
Oh, you mean you're like the dog that caught the bus?
Yeah, exactly. Where it's like people that we've been demanding it for so long that now that it's here, they're like having doubts about whether it's really what they thought it was going to be. And in some ways it isn't, you know, because people have gotten this outlaw culture associated with marijuana where there's no rules and no taxes and no regulations. And once it's legal, that's not going to be the way it is anymore.
Okay.
So there's kind of an end of an era we have.
Why
here.
Don't you kind of talk about that, the pluses and minuses of legalization? And again, in keeping with Bernie, let's think big.
Yeah, well, you know, I can't help but say that there's primarily pluses. The negatives are the fact that most of society is still afraid enough of marijuana that any regulation is going to have to control it more than it really should be controlled, because I think it's really a beneficial thing to society. You know, that people are going to find these medical benefits. People are going to find just how it enhances their experience of life, which is what we talk about in the Newbie's Guide as well, of course. But we're at a stage now where there's so many vested interests. Like when anything you talk about it, like security for marijuana. I mean, you know, people have been selling it out of their jacket pocket in a plastic bag, and nobody's been gotten hurt from that. But now we're talking about it has to be 24-hour camera surveillance at these places, like in Colorado, for example.
Well, wait. Because of the banking restrictions, federal banking restrictions, all of the money in all of these dispensaries, it's kind of like the Old West. It's like, should we go and shoot up the dispensary at 215 and, you know, run down the street on horses with the swag? I mean, in other words, it's really the Wild West because the legislation is not caught up to the culture.
Right, and because it hasn't done that, the great culture has created these people who are like the marijuana trimmers. I don't know if you know what that means, but
no, I have no idea. Please enlighten us.
Well, there are different stages of the marijuana, from the seed to the.
Oh, you mean they actually take scissors to the plants and do that?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So after the plant has been grown and cut and then dried, there are people who specialize in cutting off the leaves and getting it just to the flowers.
And they're called trimmers.
Yeah.
Wow.
But now there's machines that do that.
Uh-oh.
And so this whole culture for the past 30 or 40 years of people doing that now is kind of in a conundrum of where are they going to go next, you know? And likewise, there's people who just make their living selling a little bit of marijuana. You know, they don't really make their living on it, but it's like whether they get to pay the rent or whether they have money for their groceries,
mm-hmm.
selling a few bags of marijuana.
So it's survival.
I'm not sure how that really fits into the regulated paradigm.
Well, under the California law, you said that those small or even micro growers, think, you know, micro brewery, are protected under this new adult law up for the referendum in November in California.
Yeah, this is going to be important for that to happen, but it's subject to local regulation. And so whereas a local government can set up a system where people can open a little cafe, grow the marijuana, and sell it for a nice price in a nice environment, they can also completely ban it. And then we're left back with the guy in the street corner who's looking for somebody who wants to buy something too. We have to get past the whole stigma aspect of it. And I think that's what a lot of people have a hard time understanding within the movement, is that just by making it legal, it's going to change society's attitudes.
Oh, huge. Although having a presidential candidate say with a straight face, I'm taking this out of the schedule, that's a breakthrough that I guess you guys never really thought would ever come.
Yeah, it's like one of those pipe dreams. I tell you what, though. We were in my wife and I were in Vienna in 2000 and I forget what year, 9 is what comes to mind, when the president of Bolivia took a coca leaf out of his pocket, held it up in front of the UN Committee on Drugs and Crime, and chewed it in front of them. So we all said, wouldn't it be great if Obama would do that with a joint?
Wouldn't that be amazing?
I'm not really sure I see that happening, but I could see Bernie Sanders taking it off. And actually, you know, I could see Hillary potentially being in that position too. It's hard to tell with on the Republican side, you know, because what they've been talking about has been primarily the state's rights to do it.
Right.
Like Trump said, he's in favor of the state's rights to do it. Cruz is in favor of the state's rights to do it. Rand Paul has said he's in favor of it. So, you know, that seems to be the pattern that the Republicans are taking.
Well, I know that Rand Paul and Senator Booker from Newark, from Jersey, new senator, they've gotten together on legislation, dramatic legislation on the whole drug situation. Why don't you kind of describe some of that?
Well, they've been important on several different fronts. A lot of the things aren't quite getting through, of course, but one of the most important ones is called the CARES Act. And that would federally move marijuana into Schedule II, which Congress can do it as well. I mentioned that the president can do it, the head of the DEA can do it, and the attorney general can do it, but Congress could also do it. But what it would do, federally it would be in Schedule II, and the states where it's legal, it would be the federal government would have no authority to enforce federal law over it.
And where is that now?
It's kind of a parallel bill in the House, and they have a number of sponsors, I think 18 or plus sponsors on it, but it hasn't gotten any committee hearings or anything like that. It was introduced last year, and they're going to reintroduce it again this year.
Okay. And what do you think is going to happen to it? I mean, I
would say it'll take maybe 5 years to build up, but when we look at what happened, the DEA really made a tactical blunder when they went after the industrial hemp in Kentucky. When the federal government put in the Farm Bill for 2015 that states could allow for industrial hemp to be grown there as long as it was 0.3% THC or less,
right.
The state of Kentucky immediately opted to do that. And then the DEA tried to block the hemp seed at the border.
Wait. The DEA tried to block this, not realizing that Mitch McConnell is from Kentucky?
Well, I think they just have so much arrogance. They just thought, well, we're supposed to do that. But instead of that, they got majorly slapped down. So then both houses abruptly voted to restrict the funding that the DEA has available for enforcing hemp laws. And then there was a bunch of raids in California, and then the feds then bumped down their DEA funding to go after medical marijuana. And that was where Dana Rohrabacher was one of the main sponsors of that bill. But that got put into the budget last year too. And so, like I was saying, those have been in discussion for decades, but it just took that one major misstep by the DEA to really suddenly push it forward. So anything is possible at this point.
Well, you know, when you look at some of these decisions and you say they're really dumb, are they really dumb or are they four-dimensional chess? In other words, if you're the president and you know that you can't decriminalize marijuana coast to coast all at once, that's the objective, but you know you can't get there in one step. What if you were to, through the bureaucracy, whisper to the head of the DEA, oh, it'd be a really good idea if you would, you know, attack so-and-so, knowing it would backfire, knowing that McConnell would get his dander up, knowing that then he would take a much more proactive position. You see what I mean? People seem to say when they see someone on television making a pronouncement that that's what they believe or that's the position they're holding, whereas in fact if you do a deeper analysis, and I've done this with Obama and the space program, you find that because both Democrats and Republicans were in a period where it was anything but what the president wants, by coming out against certain things, Obama guaranteed that there would be joint action on both sides of the aisle to get funded in NASA the very things that he wanted funded, and he got it by basically saying that he didn't want it. So I'm just looking at this convoluted history of 100 years of making something criminal which should never have been made criminal, and I'm wondering if in the end game we're so involved in people trying to, I know what you know, that I know that you know, so that basically this curve is moving inexorably regardless of what the individual players claim to be doing.
I think there's a lot of that. I definitely think that Obama is looking at the long game on this stuff, that a lot of the things he's put these things in place, and particularly on the cannabis issue, I think he, rather than directly doing making the changes that we wished that he would have done, he's opted to set up these policies that have now created such a big mass of quasi-legal stuff around the country that's going to be extremely difficult to impossible to shut that back down.
Exactly.
Again.
So, well, it's the old cliche, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law. I'm not sure that's ever been encoded legally in any law, but people operate that if you own it, you're sitting on it, then you control it and you can determine what happens with it. It seems to me that Obama's subtly trying to build up this precedent to where, as you just said, the mass of the institutional movement to legalization becomes too heavy and complicated to dismantle before legalization arrives.
Right, and we've got looking at going into 2016. You've got the MPP Marijuana Policy Project is supporting initiatives in Arizona, Maine, Massachusetts, Ohio, and Nevada, and then we have California. Whoever the next president is, if he walks into office and all of a sudden he's got 10 states that have legalized marijuana, it's going to be really hard for him to come and say, I'm going to force my will upon the American people, regardless of that. And certainly it would be unpopular. I think there's so much antagonism toward the federal government these days that the whole idea that somebody who like Chris Christie, who came in and saying, like, well, we're going to use all the force of the federal government to shut these guys down, it didn't resonate that well with people. He thought he was going to get all this, drugs are bad, but instead people got, do we really need the federal government coming in and shutting down medical marijuana stores?
Well, what's interesting about Christie is I think he took that stance because he went to New Hampshire, he discovered the heroin problem, huge heroin problem, and he conflated, you know, the old that marijuana is a gateway drug. Talk a bit about that and how, you know, drug war per se is not equally attacking all the targets equally because some of them are more dangerous for reasons that are never even discussed, like consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not exactly sure where you want to go with that. Are we talking about like where Nixon was specifically launched the drug war because of his political enemies that he felt were using cannabis, or
no? I don't think I'm saying bringing it up to the current. You know, one of the reasons that Christie stayed at like 3-4%, he tried an anti-drug message in New Hampshire, which has a huge heroin problem, and I think his rigid, you know, positions on medical marijuana and certainly recreational marijuana actually, even in that political climate, did him in because he confused the two issues. It's not a drug problem. It's a hard drug problem. Consciousness-raising drugs are in a different category, as Bernie Sanders is willing to say.
Yeah, that's a huge aspect of what's going on.
Huge,
there.
And we're using that term very advisedly. Okay, so
exactly,
let's turn to your book, okay? Because
Because I was just going to get there, because in the book, The Newbie's Guide to Cannabis and the Industry, we talk about this, the historical shift that's gone on there. And we mentioned what happened with Chris Christie, as an example. And just as a side to this, my wife and I recently went to Washington, D.C. to do some lobbying. And the people there in the Senator and Congress people's staff office are saying that it's like a new era. We actually, whereas it used to be, we'd be shuttled off to the side and talk to somebody who say, well, I might agree with you, but the boss will never go along with it. This time we were the Congress member came out to talk to us and say, yeah, things have changed. We're really interested in backing this in. We realize that it's a new era here. So that's why we have a book like The Newbie's Guide to Cannabis and the Industry, because we believe that this is this new era where people just want to know and people want to get involved. And there's a lot of things that you can get wrong at this point. And a lot we've learned, so we want to make that information available to people who are just interested in getting started, either trying cannabis or getting into the industry.
Okay, so let's go to the book, go to square one. What's the first thing that we all should know that we think we know that we don't know about cannabis?
Well, I think really probably the first thing is that about the endocannabinoid system, that we have a system in our bodies that parallels the chemicals in the plant, and it helps to modulate not only our physical health and well-being, but our sensory experiences, like the way things taste, the way things feel, the way things look, the way we think about things, that brings down our stress and that gives us a relief from some of the things in life that, not without being an escape, it's actually an enhancer. So this is something that we've only discovered recently. We knew it had these characteristics, but we didn't know how integral this is to just being a human being.
This is rather remarkable. In fact, this is profound. You're saying that human beings, the human biology, has a system, a receptor system for cannabinoids, THC and the others, that is specifically designed to incorporate those chemicals, those molecules, into the human nervous system in a specific set of ways?
Exactly. And that
is. Well, no, wait. Let me stop you there then. How did that happen by accident or random chance or random evolution? Doesn't that sound like you've got a plant that's made for humans to do something as part of the human fundamental anatomy? And that raises huge questions.
Especially when you put it in the context of the hemp seed has like the perfect balance of essential fatty acids and proteins for the human body, 8 essential proteins that your body needs to combine to produce other proteins, plus the essential fatty acids, plus Edison, which is designed for the human digestive process. And the globulin in the plant is one of the closest things to the globulin in the human blood. So we not only do we have this neurological
relationship. You mean globulin is part of like hemoglobulin.
Right, exactly. And so not only do we have this neurological relationship on the cannabinoid level, but we actually have a physiological relationship to the seed.
But see, that says that we're looking at genetic engineering, either of human beings or of the plant or of both, because are there other plants like marijuana – the certain percentage of THC that literally expands consciousness, opens us up to new ideas, new experiences, new possibilities? And is that why, I mean, this is my big question of the night, is that why all this was shut down legally 100 years ago and we're just now getting to the point where we may realize the real value, the ultimate real value of this particular plant, given that physiologically we're matched to it like someone, you know, horse and carriage, love and marriage, all those twosomes that we think about?
Yeah, it's the implication certainly seems to be pretty strong to me.
What about the whole consciousness part of marijuana? I mean, to me, you say the pharmaceutical industry got their digs in because they wanted to go for single molecule, you know, drugs. And they had a financial and a kind of a medical reason for shutting out marijuana. But is there in your research, have you encountered the idea that it's basically because of its consciousness expanding properties, and you certainly don't want conscious and aware and plugged in citizens if you're trying to run a scam and control them and control their whole civilization and society and move them into areas that don't let them think, don't let them cogitate, don't let them look at the big picture in terms of who's, you know, taking advantage of them.
I see it at three different levels. The first is that if you look at the actual time period when the laws were put in place in the 1930s, it was clearly racist. And one of the things that they talked about is the way that marijuana encourages people of color to mingle with white people and to feel like they're equal with white people.
Whoa. Where was this written?
This is written by some of the people who testified at the Marijuana Tax Act and so forth. But if you look at the era's anti-marijuana information, they talk about blacks and whites getting together and having ginger-colored babies as a result of marijuana, things like that.
So they were attacking, again, the consciousness properties of a drug that lowers barriers between people who have an antipathy, a social antipathy, to where they will mingle, and they didn't want the mingling.
And Harry Anslinger specifically said that the worst effect was the effect it had on the mentality of the degraded, so-called, quote, I'm quoting him, please, degraded races, meaning people of color. So we know from the beginning that there was some aspect of it. But then I think you have to get to the Nixon era, when it was specifically people who smoked marijuana were more likely to be against the war in Vietnam. They were more likely to be for environmental. They were more likely to be countercultural in terms of economics and so forth.
So Nixon basically was, you know, these people are figuring too many things out. They're putting too many things together. They're against these policies. I'll stamp out that by stamping out the drug.
Yeah. In fact, I think he said something to the effect of, we can't make it illegal to be against the war, but we can sure as hell make it illegal to have marijuana in your pocket. I'm not sure what the exact quote, but it was something along that line. And then the next step is when you get to Reagan, where you've got actually Oliver North in the basement of the White House engineering the cocaine transfers from Nicaragua, and excuse me, not from Nicaragua, from
Honduras.
Actually, it was Nicaragua.
It was Nicaragua.
It was the Contras.
Yeah, Nicaragua and Honduras.
Yeah, and bringing them basically doing the work through the White House that led to the crack epidemic here. I what do you make of that? I mean, and that is that a consciousness thing, or was that just strictly because of the addictive character of what they were trying to pump into society? I'm not sure where the consciousness level is of why they approached it that way at that point.
Well, we're going to be doing a show tomorrow on drugs as weapons, kind of continuing this theme, because I want to go back to this idea of the physics. To me, the coincidence now of this sudden reversal politically and legally to where more and more states are authorizing medical use, and we've got four or five states, including the district, which is organizing and authorizing recreational use. The more this gets spread through society, the more people are going to, you know, take a toke and look at television and go, And I think that was part of the rationale, certainly, as you just quoted Nixon, for not wanting people to think outside the box.
Yeah, and there's the other question that a lot of people raise is the alcohol versus cannabis culture questions, because if you look at historically, the whole idea of alcohol has a very different effect on society, and most of the regulations that people are saying they want to treat marijuana like alcohol. But if you look on alcohol, it has all these connections to violence, it has connections to brain damage, it has connections to impaired driving and things like that, domestic violence. The marijuana just doesn't even have those things. And so in a certain way, we've created this paradigm for ourselves where we feel like all social drugs should be treated similarly. But, you know, I don't really think I think we have to go through a stage where we treat it that way. But ultimately, society is going to see exactly what you're talking about, Richard, that the benefits of having cannabis more available and more integrated into our society is going to bring us out of this period of feeling, oh, look, we have to regulate it so much. And over time, people just adjust it, become comfortable, and we're going to acculturalize more further and more deeply into society.
Okay, well, when we come back, we're almost up to a break now at the bottom of the hour. Yes, we are at the bottom of the hour here on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning is Chris Conrad, and we're discussing this very complicated situation with marijuana legalization, the reasons for it being criminalized, the fact that there seems to be a trend curve now where people all over the country have suddenly realized that the big bugaboo, the big problem with marijuana may not be what it was claimed to be all along. Anyway, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. This is Bobby Bright, all the way from Australia. It's 2:28 here in the land of enchantment, and we shall return.
Just a boy who can't say no. I'm a child of good old rock and roll. Loving good to me.
You know what they say about drugs and rock and roll.
High times, there's been tears. Seen a lot as I travel around. Through it all, there's been the sound of good old rock and roll.
And we are back on the other side of midnight, half an hour to go, with my guest this morning, Chris Conrad. We're discussing the very complicated issue of the decriminalization of marijuana from sea to shining sea. So let's go back to your book and kind of pick some highlights of things that people should know as we enter this really interesting new era.
Well, one of the things that people should know is that the nature of cannabis has changed somewhat. In that, whereas during the 1960s and so forth, when a lot of people were first smoking, the marijuana was maybe 3 or 5% THC. Mm-hmm. Today, it's often around 10 or 15%, and it, in some cases, it's been up to 25% or more THC. And now that they have concentrates, it can be 65, even to 95% THC. And so, people who aren't used to that, who may have smoked at various points of their life, they have something nowadays that's called dabbing. And so
called what?
Dabbing.
Dabbing. D-A-B-B-I-N-G.
Correct. And like the old Burl Cream commercials, a little dab will do you.
A little dab will, yeah. Okay.
A little dab will definitely do you. About maybe a 30th of a or a 20th of a gram of this heavy concentrate is evaporated. And so it's like smoking a joint in one breath.
Oh, my God.
And so people have been known to fall over after taking a hit and a puff of that. And they don't often necessarily enjoy it that much because it's so strong that they feel it's uncomfortable. So one of the things we always suggest to people is that you should just start off with trying lower quantities. Likewise, when people eat, it takes an hour for the effect of
Yes. Now, let me interrupt you there. Do you remember the very famous New York Times correspondent? Oh, what's her name? Not Molly.
I do remember, but I don't remember her name either.
Yeah, it's going to come to me. I see her every morning. She's on Morning Joe, and she's actually pretty interesting. Anyway, she went to Colorado when they decriminalized, and she apparently bought some edibles, went to her hotel room, ate them all, and spent 3 days in a fetal position because she was stupid. I mean, really.
And she disregarded the warnings on the label.
Well, she claimed there were no warnings on the label. Anyway, the point is, in the area of edibles, I mean, I've had issues with edibles, you know, years and years ago. Edibles are very difficult. How do you educate a population that you have to exercise, you know, impulse restraint? You know, you have to wait a period of time, like an hour or so, to see if that cupcake or that half cupcake that you consumed actually is going to do what you wanted.
Yeah, well, the thing with that is that when people smoke marijuana, it goes it gets activated by the heat, and then the THC goes directly into the bloodstream through the lungs, and then the heart pumps it straight to the brain.
Through
and you
the
feel
blood-brain barrier,
in a few
yeah.
seconds. Yeah. So if you've smoked one puff and you feel like it's enough, you can just stop.
Marine Dowd.
Yeah, she was the New York Times columnist.
Right, right.
But when you eat cannabis, everybody has a different response. And so three different things can happen. Either the THC can activate and go through your system, pretty much at the same level as if you had smoked it, but it's going to take an hour to do that. Or it can be digested and you get less through your system because your digestive fluids have broken down the THC. Mm. Or the THC can be adjusted, metabolized again into a hydroxy 11 delta 9 THC, which can be up to 10 times stronger than THC itself. And so when people eat it, unless you know your system and the time of day and the kind of cannabis, you can end up getting no effect at all, or very, very intense effect, or a mild effect.
Why did you mention time of day? Because I was going to bring up time of day for a totally different reason. Go ahead.
Well, just because people's metabolism is different during the, at different
times.
And so, you know, with your digestive, likewise, it's like if you've eaten recently and then you eat an edible, it's going to take longer to feel the effect. If you haven't eaten for a while and you haven't taken an edible, you feel it more quickly.
In terms
but the
of
problem
this,
is that the people, they take it and then they think, well, I didn't feel anything.
Exactly.
They eat a little bit more, they think, well, I didn't feel anything. And so, by the time an hour has passed, they've maybe eaten four or five times as much as they should have.
So how do you create a context in a country of 350 million people if legalization proceeds and more people are exposed to cannabis in various forms, including edibles? How do you keep the people in the edibles department from not screwing it up for everybody else? Because like Maureen Dowd, they don't get it, that it isn't going to be an instantaneous feedback loop.
Yeah, and you know, that's just going to have to be through the educational process. I think that the other side
So what are you guys, you activists, doing so you don't have this social hiccup which will make it bad for everybody? You've got to somehow bring those folks along so, like Maureen Dowd, they don't do dumb things.
So what they're talking about in the California initiative is that they're going to limit they're going to have that package in a way that each dose is demarcated so that people would have to be conscious that they're eating multiple doses.
That's good.
Now, the initial dose is going to be much weaker than somebody like myself or if you have experience that you would want. But so it's really designed for people who don't know and they just say, well, this is a dose, 10 milligrams. Almost anybody can handle 10 milligrams. When you get to 20, 30, 40 milligrams, you know, fewer and fewer people can handle those higher dosages. But once
well, particularly if 25% of that is pure THC.
Right. And so then the idea is that if you know that you can eat 50 milligrams and you can eat five of the little squares, you know, you're consciously eating five squares. And if a person just eats one square, they're still only going to get 10 milligrams, which is a relatively safe dose.
Hmm. Okay, we have someone who's joined us. Good morning. Where are you calling from?
Bob Tennant.
Okay, and your name?
John.
John?
Yeah.
Okay, what would you like to ask Chris?
Chris, I don't know if you guys talked about it, but, you know, research that I did a while ago, and because I quit the show late, I got a problem in the kitchen. But anyway, is that the way I looked at it, it appeared to me that the wood industry was fully behind the timber industry, fully behind blocking marijuana usage because hemp is a renewable resource that's a lot easier to make paper out of and other goods. Did you find that or not?
Yeah, and we did talk about that a little bit earlier in terms of the way that the coincidental, as it were, passage of the Marijuana Tax Act right after the equipment was invented that made hemp a viable resource again. So that's an important fact that you brought up there. So thanks for bringing it back up.
Yeah, unfortunately, we dropped him. I guess Skype cut out on us. Let's go to this call. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I met Chris quite a few years ago. My name's Eric.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Eric.
Hi, Chris. We spent a weekend together in a ranch outside of Helena, Montana.
Back I
about
remember that.
You do?
Oh,
we
yeah,
had a great,
great
time. I was one of the organizers, Eric. I don't know if you remember me. I'm a person with AIDS. I've had AIDS now for 25 years, and it's because of men and people like Chris and Nikki that I've been able to survive this disease.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you're still out there. And, you know, Eric, as you know, at that point, it looked like things were going to go really good for Montana because the medical marijuana movement was very strong and there were a lot of patients. But then shortly thereafter, we wound up with the Obama administration in 2010 doing this massive crackdown. And where people were rounded up in Montana and basically almost
my business, I had a business partner who passed away in prison, Richard Floor.
Oh, geez.
Because of that, a very good person, a very good person. No, I was lucky. I don't know how I avoided it. I was pretty heavily involved in getting Montana cannabis going.
You guys really paid the dues. We paid our dues out here in California too, but not nobody did it like you guys.
We lost everything. We lost everything. Our law is really screwed up, and that's what I'd like to warn people about. These law enforcement agencies that are used to these big budgets because of marijuana enforcement, they're not rolling over easily, you know.
No,
go ahead, guys. I was just going to say it's kind of like private prisons. If you put the money incentive, the profit motive into the loop, you really create crazy things. Montana and Wyoming are two states where there's an awful lot of retired agency people, CIA, NSA, all the alphabet agencies. Is part of the problem that you're dealing with agency people, as you just said, who basically don't want their income source to go away?
Well, especially here in central Montana, I mean, we're surrounded by missiles. Okay,
yes,
that should give you a hint. You know, there's so many law enforcement agencies just in my little town of 5,000 people. It's ridiculous. And it's a real conservative area that's been brainwashed, you know. And going to the edibles and stuff like that, you know, we have to re-educate people. This was known 100 years ago, even 80 years ago, how to prepare cannabis in various forms, so for edibles and tinctures and all different types of medicines.
I'm just thinking, you know, with Maureen Dowd as an example, all it takes is one amateur doing something really dumb to cast a light on a whole industry because the proper educational things are not in place to tell people how to use usefully and wisely their new freedom.
Well, this
and
is
a lot of that's imposing
because of your clarity. You kind of see these things. I've seen it too. It's already been happening in Washington State, where they're going after some of these edible manufacturers, you know, because the dosage isn't, you know, how much. A lot of these guys are buying their marijuana from different purveyors. And so the makeup of the plant, each plant is a little different. So your THC levels are different for every single batch. So all that stuff has to be tested now. And with proper labeling and people working with the state properly, it should work properly.
Well, I think Montana is a good example of a cautionary tale here, though, because before there was the Cole memo, there was another memo that said the federal government was going to leave medical marijuana alone, and that's when all these groups in Montana.
That's when we jumped
around.
In.
And then the administration changed this policy, and slam, bam, they take all these people down. So it shows you how fragile this whole thing is without the federal change.
Hmm.
Yeah, and to go to where Chris is speaking of, there's a great documentary you can see on Hulu that's called Code of the West. And that's on it takes place during this whole time frame. It was a documentary being made on Montana cannabis. And then the feds came in and the legislature was happening. And it's really, really interesting.
So you just Google Code of the West and it'll take you to this documentary that shows the feds coming into Montana and doing what you have just described.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and tearing down our beautiful medical marijuana law. Now it's almost impossible. The Republicans in the legislature just really took advantage at that opportunity. They did it right during the legislative season. They went and put us all out of business. And so the Republican legislature bit into that and tore apart our law. First, they tried to get rid of medical marijuana. They couldn't do that. The governor vetoed it. Then their second attempt was virtually to get rid of it, where it, now our law, it's just really impossible for patients. Me being a long-term patient, the only way I can have a supply of medical marijuana of my own is by growing it. But not too many people can do that.
So, Chris, if there was federal legislation, or in this case, if President Sanders, with a stroke of a pen, took marijuana off the schedule, the FDA schedule, what would happen to local communities and people like our friend here in terms of Montana?
Well, most of the state laws would just remain in place. So people would not be immediately that different unless they were involved with moving stuff around state lines than the federal. That's technically where the federal law is supposed to kick in, is state lines. But in reality, they have not limited themselves to that. But the different, it wouldn't change the state laws. That's where we have a multiple rulings by the courts that say that federal law and state law are different jurisdictions. And so they don't have to be the same. That's why California, for example, could have medical marijuana, even though the federal government banned it.
So it would really have to be
where we're in danger, because these people have been getting these great funds from the politicians to the jailers to the sheriffs. They're trying to stack the deck every opportunity they've got. You know, the war is never going to be over, at least not for the next 20 or 30 years.
You think it's that long?
I really do. We'll get legalization, but it's going to come with a lot of caveats, you know.
Okay.
And we're talking about a plant. Let's be real, guys. We're talking about a plant, something that it's a weed.
Yeah.
Grows on the side of the road. That's why they've got all these weed spraying programs. That was starting in the 1930s by Anslinger to get rid of the ditch weed.
Interesting. Okay.
Another issue here when you talk about why I don't think it's going to take as long as Eric does, obviously.
I don't either. No. I think the trend curve is much
– But nonetheless, another part of this whole thing that we haven't really talked about, Richard, is the whole property forfeiture, the fact that the federal government can use the drug laws to go in and take people's bank accounts, their companies, their real estate, their anything that the government wants to take somebody pretty much by using the property forfeiture laws. And in general, they don't even have to have – they can just charge you and take your property. They don't have to convict you. So as soon as people get in trouble, the first thing they do – is the prosecutors take your bank accounts, then how are you supposed to hire a lawyer? Most of the lawyers I know want money.
Yes, I've known a few. Okay, we have another caller. Good morning. Where are you calling from?
Good morning, Richard. This is Mike in Montana.
Montana. We were just talking about you.
Yeah, it's a little chilly up here this evening. Mr. Conrad, if I was interested in growing and selling marijuana as a business, considering the various laws of all the states, where would be the best place for me to start that business?
Oh, that's a good question.
And how can I get seeds? How could I get seeds and or clones legally to start that business?
I'll bet that's in a certain book.
Well, there is a book that talks a little bit about that called The Newbie's Guide to Cannabis and the Industry. But, the problem that we're running into right now is that there's this, what we call the green rush. So, Colorado was a great place, but then everybody moved to Colorado. California was a great place, but then everybody moved out to California. Right now, I think Oregon probably has your best options for the next year, because they are also have a system that's going to allow for small business models to function. But then after that, I think California is going to be definitely the place with the biggest market. And from my reading of the different laws, I think we're going to have the simplest regulation. And we also have a policy that the voters are going to hopefully pass if we do pass ALMA, which I hope we do, the Adult Use Act. It's going to be telling the legislature to remove obstacles and barriers and hardships, and to not make anything unreasonable for people to start businesses here. But the problem is that you have to be a resident here for a year, or I think it's a 1 year and perhaps a 2 year period, before you could own a business out here. So you would have to be looking ahead if you're thinking of California. Otherwise, I think Oregon is probably the next place I would look at.
All right, appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
Morning.
Speaking of Oregon.
Hi, Darren.
It's Darren from Oregon. Yeah, it's legal here. It's like no big deal. Downtown, people come from out of town and they just like, where's the nearest dispensary? Oh, it's one block down this way, or there's 10 others this way. They're all over the place.
But you guys don't have any on-site consumption, right? There was that one shop, the world-famous Cannabis Cafe, but are they still in operation?
I don't think they are. Who knows? I'm not all into it like some people, but I guess they had a bar where you'd go in and you could try a bunch of different ones, and I don't know if that's still available.
Well, that's what they have in Amsterdam. And Robin and I actually had a little time, you know, we were playing tourist. Our organizer for the conference, you know, actually squired us around for 2 days. We had an incredible time in Amsterdam. And we visited one of these little cafes. And it just, you know, it was like a cafe, except instead of
drink.
It's like
a bar.
Yeah, it was like a bar. You know, it had nice mirrors, had nice woodwork. You know, there was kind of a heavy smell in the air that I couldn't quite place. And, you know, it was just there. So is that what we're looking forward to in the United States, where this just becomes, you know, you want to not do alcohol, you want to do something that doesn't change you the way alcohol does?
Yeah, I'm anticipating that, but we have problems, like we said. In Oregon, they don't allow on-site consumption. I don't think they do in Washington either, but California will.
Yeah, you have to go in and talk to them, and they'll tell you about it. They're the people that, you know, work at the dispensaries know all about it, and they fill you in. So you have to take their word for it.
But, so where do people go to smoke?
Legally, it's funny because I work at a hotel, and legally you can't smoke in public, but everybody does, and the cops never do anything. And we just tell them to go to certain spots, you know, and smoke away. I just try to stay away from everybody else.
that's what we had in San Francisco at a conference. They said 50 feet away from the door, please. And then other than that, they didn't care.
And don't do it near the air conditioning intake.
good point there.
All right. Well, I guess that's all I have to say. I did have one question about the history of it.
Yeah.
Sure,
how far back have people been smoking it? I know hemp goes way back. Have they been smoking it in all cultures forever? I mean, like, for thousands of years, or?
Well, we have for thousands of years, people have used smoking huts. They've had the burning cannabis incense in dwellings, and they've had smoking mounds. But pipes and stuff really just comes to after they came to America. Like, in India, they actually used to have this cannabis in milk in a beverage called bhang. And smoking didn't really come along until after the Europeans went over there, and then they invented the chillum.
Okay, so it's kind of been worldwide, though?
Yeah, except the idea of the pipe is a new invention, but smoking is not.
Right. Now, how do we know the pipe's a new invention? Because, you know, the peace pipe is kind of a long-standing tradition. Didn't you ever wonder what was in that peace pipe? I mean, seriously! If in Reefer Madness, you know, the crazies, the racists, were afraid that because the people smoked, they would mingle together and conjugate and have kids and, oh, awful, you know, cats and dogs living together, all that. Don't you think the peace pipe had something kind of motivating in it?
Yeah, I don't know what all they have in those peace pipes. I've talked to actually several people, I think including John Trudell, the late poet, a Native American poet, who believed that cannabis has been part of the Native Americans' heritage of herbs. And in that case, it would have been in there. But
how would you think of this? What was the peace pipe about? It was two opposing tribes out to cut each other's throats, you know, in a very interesting way with rituals and liturgies and, you know, all kinds of ways you could do it and ways you couldn't do it and counting coup and all that stuff. And then you sit down with your enemies and you pass a pipe around. What is more illogical than not to assume that an herb, a substance that will allow people to drop their barriers and become more real and talk with each other as real people, that's not part of that ceremony? I don't think so.
Yeah, I think it, definitely if they headed around, I think it definitely would be part of it. But we just don't know for sure. It appears that the first cannabis in America seems to have come from, by the Spaniards or either perhaps the Vikings.
Mm. Okay. Darren, anything else?
Nope.
All
Thanks,
right.
guys.
Thank you,
well, Mike. Thank you, Darren.
You're welcome.
Okay, we've got Michael here. Michael, you can just slide in here. We got about 2 minutes. Michael? Michael? Maybe Michael's Skype's not working. I'll say it. Try it again. There we are. Okay, last couple, 3 minutes. What would you like to, besides the book, which I really think I should read, what would you like to plug? We've got websites. We've got activist things going on. There's a law in California. There's a referendum, you know, coming
well,
up.
I would like to be able to come to our news service website, theleafonline.com. My website is chrisconrad.com, and that one you'll if you're interested in California law especially, that's where you can get a lot of information there about my books. But theleafonline.com, we try to keep people apprised of the situation.
Are you saying Leaf Online?
The Leaf Online.
The Leaf, okay. The Leaf
you know,
Online.
You know how it is. Got to stick a thaw in there sometimes to get the name you want. But it's a new service where we try to keep people up to date on the not only just the news about cannabis, but the social and political developments that are going along as well. So I really recommend people to check that out. And my wife, Mickey Norris, she heads up the Cannabis Consumers Campaign. It urges people to come out of the closet if you're a cannabis smoker and it's safe to do so. So I would have to join her in that. And one other thing is that there's this project I'm working on. It's called the 420 Archives. And what we're trying to do is to get a track record of the hidden history of marijuana, the growers who've been underground, the people who are activists, the people who spent long years in prison for a few joints, and make those stories capture them before this generation passes away. It's been you know, more than 50 years since I think Bob Dylan smoked a joint with the Beatles, and it's been a heck of a half a century.
Oh my gosh. Well, I should add the Carl Sagan story when we had him on the ship. He's sitting in a corridor in high seas, and we're all talking about cosmology and aliens, and I mean, it was amazing. What was more amazing is that Carl Sagan, at a time when it was illegal, was doing it on a ship in public. Well, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, cats, dogs, and other entities out there, this has been another edition of The Other Side of Midnight. Remember, tomorrow morning, same time, same bat channel, and we'll be delving into the idea of drugs as weapons. By all means, don't miss that one. So until tomorrow morning, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone.